Hey everyone, thanks for tuning in to Myopia Movies. This week we're listening to Aliens. Now, I don't know about you all, but this is the one I saw more when I was younger. The first one was kind of a horror movie, and I was scared of scary stuff. But this one is pure action, and it's still horror action. I mean, that damn kid and cat keep jumping out and scaring the hell out of us. But overall, I'd say this movie is a lot more fun. I mean, whenever you've got, like, mech suits and stuff, you're in for a good time. We're continuing our Alien series, and thank you to all of you for tuning in and doing all you do to make our show possible. So, share, review, and thanks. Welcome to Aliens. This is number two of our series of the Alien franchise. Just Daniel and I today.
Daniel, sir. He's Hicks.
Yeah, and we are working on kind of getting through these movies in order. This is our second entry, but, I mean, we've seen all these movies. We're going to talk about all of them.
At some point, we've seen all of them. Do you remember back in 97 when Resurrection was about to come out and the teaser trailer had Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star sung by this five-year-old as, like, the song underneath the trailer?
If I recall correctly, it gives it kind of a like a Freddy Krueger vibe. Like the 1-2, Freddy's coming for you.
I guess it's what they were going for. They didn't succeed.
But the thing is, and it's stupid. I know it's stupid because I'm pitching this as a thing that we get, which is terrible, which is, what if an alien came to Earth? Right? I mean, because that's what AVP is, which I know we've already released, and AVP2 is, which is also even worse, right? We'll get to it. But this movie starts on a base. Like, they've terraformed, and this stuff is all supposed to be there. What I want to see is Alien versus Family. Like, they're not going to do it because it's franchises that are crossed, even though they might both be Universal. No, one's Paramount. But, like, something like they come across the Starship Enterprise, and it's a spaceship filled with families. That's a better idea, right? Like,
Does God need with a face hugger?
Number one, what are you telling me is on this ship? Some sort of alien? Well, I mean, Mr. Worf is an alien. That was terrible.
I'll fuck your mouth, Picard.
That's even worse.
I don't know who Worf is.
No.
Oh, Worf is the Klingon, isn't he?
So it'd be, I like how rough it is, Captain.
I've seen one Next Generation movie, and that's about it.
First Contact?
Yeah.
First Contact's the good one, though.
First Contact's great. I'm not a Trekkie.
Two ticks, Freck. I don't know, man. I was one of those kids who's afraid of the awkwardness of it when I was in high school. I've since gone back. Frankly, the problem with it is not anything about it. The movies, I've seen all of them multiple times, all three series. And frankly, I kind of like the JJ ones. Some are better than others, but I'm totally fine with
that's
them.
That's where I drew the line, because everybody was praising the second one, Into Darkness, was it?
Yeah, the one with Benedict Cumberbatch.
When it got released, like, in 85 or 86 on Rotten Tomatoes, and then I saw it, and I'm like, really?
We'll get into this one day, maybe, but Star Wars I like. But Star Wars really should be movies, because Star Wars, it's a wide universe, it's an interesting universe, and there are books, and books I like. I like the Thrawn books, for example. I really do. I've read a lot of the comics that have come out from Marvel in the last decade. They're excellent. But the thing about it is, it's a wide, wide world, and I like to hear the superhero part of it, right? That's the interesting thing. Star Trek, I'm interested in the show. I like the movies, I do. But it's neat to see how big the world is, and, like, it's a better premise for a show than Star Wars generally is. I like The Mandalorian. I really do. No problems here. But I know people are going to at me, and they can. They're fine. I really don't care. But the idea that your explorer is out in space and you're discovering, you know, strange new civilizations, the Kirk thing gives at the beginning is great. I'm totally behind that premise. And that's why it sucks so bad when they screw the premise up. It's why when The X-Files is good, X-Files is the best. And when X-Files is bad, it's literally the cheesiest thing. someone who's skeptical, someone who believes, are digging through things which shouldn't exist and probably don't exist, but may exist. And so when you swing and a miss, you swing really hard.
And of course, all of this was inspired by Bill Paxton in Aliens, which is what we're talking about today.
Oh, God. We're going to have to talk about Bill Paxton because he's one of my favorites. He's a great character actor. When he shows up in anything, it's great. The fact that 3-foot-tall Bill Paxton is one of the first people who walks up to a beautiful naked Arnold Schwarzenegger in Terminator, and he goes, "What do we got here?" The balls on that tiny man compared to that huge Austrian, right? He's in Predator 2?
Yeah, I think so.
He's in this? Like, my God, that man just showed up in everything, and God bless him for it.
And he was great in True Lies, if you remember that, where he was the car salesman trying to pretend he was a spy for Jamie Lee Curtis.
That's right. That's right. I mean, and he is in... Have we done Twister?
We have not, but he is in Twister.
Oh, God, we've talked about doing Twister so much now that I keep thinking we've done it, but we haven't.
So let's get back to Aliens, because I think this is a movie that needs a lot of context, and I think there's something that I need to clarify about it.
That you hate this movie.
That's what I want to clarify.
I know. He was in Vertical Limit as well.
He was the villain in Vertical Limit.
He was, and he was in Titanic. He is in James Cameron's stable of actors.
Probably one of the only two. It was him and Sigourney Weaver, and that was about it, because James Cameron, for the longest time, was a humongous asshole to everyone on his sets.
Who is he married to? The director.
He's been married to Catherine Bigelow.
Bigelow, that's who I was thinking of. Yes, he's been married to a lot of women.
That was the last time, and this is something I'll get into later, but one of the best scripts he's ever written was Strange Days. Have you seen that mm-hmm. movie? And she directed that movie. That was a perfect melding, which of course meant that the movie bombed.
We'll get into him more because his fingerprints are all over this movie. And Jim Cameron, for the fact that now he is going to be the person who bankrupts Disney, he's going to be the one who brings that whole thing down.
Yeah, with, what, Avatars 2, 3, 4, 5, Avatar Returns,
there are literally 5 listed on IMDb right
Good
now.
Good Lord.
What he's more known for than directing, I think he's directed only 20-some-odd movies, maybe, and some of them are videos.
I don't know how many credits he's got on IMDb. I can only think of like maybe less than 10 feature films that he's done.
Oh, you're right. He's done maybe 10 of them, and then 6 are in post-production now.
What's the 6th?
Avatar 2, 3, 4, 5, The Last Train to Hiroshima, which was delayed, God knows what that is, and something called The Informationist. No idea.
Ugh. I know for a while he was going to do that Alita movie that came out was it last year that came out?
It was, and it was pretty good, actually.
I got it on Vudu. I haven't had a chance to watch it yet. I've heard good things, and I know he wrote the script and produced it, but Robert Rodriguez directed it. But he was, for the longest time, that was going to be his next big thing.
Well, and like a lot of directors we talked about from the 80s in particular, like John Hughes, he's known for directing a handful of movies, but he's written something like 3 or 4 times as many as he's actually made. You know, and that's what it is. And yeah, he did Alita Battle Angel that came out last year, which is, again, if you haven't seen it, it's a popcorn in the theater movie. It's not big, it's not deep. I know some people didn't like the fact that it's more whitewashed than it should be. I mean, it's Christoph Waltz. It's a battle angel. Like, I, if you're not sold on the title of a little girl being a battle angel, whatever the hell that is, you're not going to like it.
Do you remember his TV show?
Was that the one, Dark something?
Dark Angel with Jessica Alba.
That's right. Frankly, of his properties, the one I'm the most interested in by far is Terminator. Although
But that's gone off the rails.
Yeah, and what was he directed the most recent one, didn't he?
He didn't direct it. He produced it, I think.
Oh, God. So he came back for that piece of shit?
Yeah.
Oh, great. So let's start on this.
All right.
Aliens, which, by the way, fuck you. You can call it Alien 2, man. I'm fine with that. Aliens, I guess, is the teaser because there's more than one alien. We also get the name Xenomorph in this, which will be whatever.
Yeah.
We'll fucking get there. So the movie starts out, smash cut, to Ripley being made fun of.
Now, can we go back to what happened between this movie and the first one?
Sure.
Because there was a 7-year delay in the sequel, which back in the day was still a pretty long time.
But isn't that Jim Cameron's thing? Because the first Terminator and the second Terminator are 6 years apart?
The first one was 84. The second one was 91, I think.
Yeah, 7 years.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, in that case, though, it's because what he wanted to do for the second one was just required so much more money.
Oh my God, the Jim Cameron story. He must be the most charming human being who's ever been.
That's not true at all.
Well, no, but how else are you going to go to someone and be like, you know, I just don't have enough movie money to make this movie and get $6 billion out of Disney for four movies when the first one came out, what, 2009?
Yeah.
It's been 11 years and we still don't have a sequel, but they've been making them for a decade?
I don't know.
He must be charming because there's no other way this works.
All right, I'm going to go ahead and say my piece about Jimmy Cameron here.
Yeah, tell me about Jim.
Yeah, good old Jimmy. He prefers Jimmy, by the way, because I personally know him. I go to those vegan sushi restaurants that he enjoys, but gross. I hear he's mellowed out lately. But the thing about his movies is he is one of the most incredible technical wizards that there's ever been.
Yeah.
What I mean is that when it comes to special effects, when it comes to filming techniques, when it comes to all of that flash that we really associate with modern blockbusters, he's one of the foremost experts at it. His scripts, his stories, his dialogue, and some of his characters, particularly his children characters, are terrible and annoying. So I don't get why people like proclaim him one of the greatest filmmakers of all time, because he's more of a special effects wizard than he is a director. If you like this movie, great, because the thing about this movie is there are some great moments in it. It's got some of the best supporting characters in this entire franchise, which we'll get into.
I will say the perfect example of what you're describing is The Abyss.
Mm.
When I was a kid, I saw it and I thought it was a cool movie. I've rewatched it recently. It is boring as sin, but it's a masterpiece of using early CGI.
Yeah.
Right.
So is Terminator 2, and those special effects hold up very well.
Yeah, and it even has that weird kind of Michael Bay thing that Michael Bay wishes Michael Bay could do, which is they're all the explosions and the gunshots and everything, but the special effects do the thing that everyone, Stallone, should learn from, which is that they are subtle. They are not over the top. They are subtle.
No, I thought the Michael Bay thing that he wishes he could do was have an erection around a woman who's his own age.
Yeah, right. I mean, no comment on that. So this movie starts out with Ripley being kind of thawed out and resurrected by, you know, medical staff on a base associated with
Weyland-Yutani, which I think this movie is where that name came from.
I believe Weyland is the other one, but it's not Weyland-Yutani. Well,
they refer to it as the company, I think, the first one.
But it's such a sci-fi thing, like you just can say the company, and they're mining X from Y, and they're going across the galaxy. Because it's the first one is really a working class horror.
Yeah. Right?
This one is Space Marines. This is, hey.
Now, that's another thing. This invented that whole concept of Space Marines from like, I guess the Starship Troopers book did it first, but this did it for movies. So Halo borrowed a lot from this movie. The actual Starship Troopers movie borrowed a lot from this. Which, at the time, that was a good thing to do, and it's always great to innovate. But nowadays, it just seems, I think, kind of dated.
Well, and to be fair to James Cameron, he has nothing to do with that. People ripped him off. But this is what? This is 84?
This came out in 86.
86, excuse me. Terminator came out in 84.
Yep.
This is, you know, 7 years before Doom, even. Like,
oh, this is, when was Doom released? 94?
93.
Oh, 90, yep, you're right.
But yeah, like the idea of a space marine is a cool idea. And like you said, Robert Heinlein's, the book had already come out. But the book is, as I guess, look at the episode we did on the movie. But the book is, you know, kind of a pseudo corrective anti-fascist, maybe fascist book.
It's pretty fascist.
It's pretty fascist. And he kind of isn't sure the author isn't sure which side he's on, so it feels very wishy-washy, and I haven't read it in a while, so
I think the movie's better than the book
because it's also shorter. And that is something else we need to talk about. Jim Cameron is the reason that movies are 3 hours long now. He has to be. I don't know what the original length of this movie was. I watched the special edition, which I think is the director's cut.
Yeah, which has like that's another thing about Jimmy Cameron. Again, I get to call him Jimmy.
Yeah, of course you do.
His director's cuts are a lot better than what gets released in theaters, like the Terminator 2 director's cut.
Yeah.
That is so awesome. Much better than the theatrical version.
Yeah, and I don't know who his producers were that cut his movies to ribbons, but he really has an eye. And as you said, the one thing that he's very good at is the arranging, the figuring out where the effects goes. Don't stop the flow of his movies. Messing with the flow is the thing. But I will say, this movie does not need to be 2 hours and 18 minutes long. The original version was. The director's cut you and I watched?
The director's cut's like
2:32.
Yeah. Although those scenes that they have in the director's cut are really necessary for the story.
They flow together so well, I don't remember what was what, so we'll talk about it. But I just remember that Titanic was like 3 hours long.
It was two VHS tapes back in the day.
My word. And I have that somewhere. I haven't even watched it. We got it at a yard sale for a dollar.
The trick is that the second tape was the only good part of the movie.
Kind
of. Because that's where all the sinking happens.
Which, again, is special effects, like mastery.
Although at about 1 hour and 20 minutes into the first tape is boobs.
Some quality boobers.
Hey.
No one's complaining.
Do you see me complaining about the breasts?
Kate Winslet. I do not see you complaining about Kate Winslet nude. But Avatar was too long. And I love True Lies. True Lies is long for an Arnold movie.
I don't remember how long it is, but I remember that being a lot shorter than like what James Cameron usually does.
But even case in point. Like the first Alien is what, like 100 minutes? 100 and change?
It's about 2 hours, but it feels a lot quicker, though. I mean, because they establish the characters, they establish the stakes, and they just go at it. I think the director's cut was like an hour. It was like 115 minutes.
So I'm going to stop us for 1 second. Everyone has seen this movie, right?
I'm sure they have.
If you haven't seen this movie, stop. And it's funny, we are 20 minutes into this recording-ish. We haven't given away a spoiler yet, but my assumption is everyone's seen this movie. I think the further we get into the series, less people have seen them.
It's been copied so much, too. So even if you haven't seen this movie, you've seen scenes from this movie and other things.
And, I mean, let's be honest. Jim Cameron saw a lot of things to make this movie, including Commando. There's the scene where she's suiting up at the end is exactly Arnold suiting up for Commando. Like, down to the click, 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 opening up a Velcro pouch, putting something in the Velcro pouch on her chest, sealing up something else, clicking it into place, putting something into her pocket, which is great. And Sigourney Weaver should be said sometimes in the same breath as Arnold Schwarzenegger.
She was nominated for an Oscar for this movie.
Deservedly so.
She didn't win, but...
She was great. And, frankly, like Marvel movies and DC movies... action movies that were passed over for a long time for any sort of award as a genre. And we're recording this right around the Oscars. Oscars are terrible. You can watch... No, watch them. Enjoy them. And frankly, I'm not someone who watches a lot of movies outside of this. A lot of the movies, my knowledge, for those of you who've been paying attention, is stuff from 10 years ago. I have a toddler at home. I watch a lot more on Netflix, Amazon Prime, Vudu than I do in the theaters.
And Disney Plus.
And Disney Plus, right. So my knowledge comes from... you know, my film minor and seeing things secondhand. It does a good job at bringing attention to documentaries, foreign films, and good dramas that otherwise people won't see, though Amazon and Netflix are fucking with that right now. No one should be emotionally invested in the Academy Awards, and they are constantly behind the times about what's good. The idea that Sing Street was chosen over was not chosen over La La Land. Case in point, Sing Street is much better than La La Land.
To give you an idea of when we're recording this, I'm still pissed off that a Sterling K. Brown wasn't nominated for Best Actor this year.
I mean, my daughter doesn't understand, but would be upset about Frozen 2, and I'm sick of Toy Story movies. This one was fine, but you can't just keep making me cry and expect to win an Academy Award each time.
I was kind of done with Toy Story 2. I don't think Toy Story 3 was... it was fine. It was entertaining, but it's like it wasn't like this special milestone.
I'm just done with them hitting the same notes over and over again. And frankly, I saw everything, whatever it was, 5 years ago. I think Logan was one of the best movies of the year, but Logan's never going to win because it's a Marvel movie.
Well, I mean, Joker's up for Best Picture.
Yes, and it's not going to win, and it shouldn't win. It's
no,
not
it shouldn't
even
win.
It's not even the best of the genre of the last 10 years. Frankly, if you're going to nominate a Joker movie, nominate Batman 89. Right?
Well, Heath Ledger won an Oscar for being the Joker.
Yeah, for killing himself.
Aw, dude.
No, I think he did a good job, but the reason he was nominated and won was because he committed suicide. I don't even think he was the best actor that year.
You think it was a deliberate suicide?
I thought he did deliberately kill himself.
I think it was an accidental overdose on prescription pills.
Regardless, I think because he died, he won the award. The reason I say suicide, even if it wasn't, was the rumor at the time was the mind of the character got so into him that it made him unstable. And I remember those articles being written.
Oh,
and
I do
remember
too.
The like that they were saying he had become mildly schizophrenic or more addicted to drugs by playing this deranged character, which is horseshit. The only Academy Award, other than, you know, effects, given to a comic book movie was for that. That's horseshit.
I know we're wildly off topic, but I would like to share one story regarding Please. That. Some of you may remember this, the alternate reality game around the Dark Knight and all those websites they put up. One of them was basically encouraging people in cities to put on Joker makeup and go to a landmark in the city and get your picture taken there, and they'd display it on their website, right? So me and a bunch of friends in college did that.
No kidding.
And it gets better.
Yeah.
A while later, they mailed out fake copies of the Gotham Gazette, I think it was, whatever their Gotham newspaper was, and they included articles surrounding the movie, including some fake pictures. And by God, if you have one of those, I am in one of those pictures.
No kidding.
Oh, yeah.
That reminds me of, is it Joss Whedon and Dr. Horrible, right? Because Dr. Horrible took off surprisingly out of nowhere. And so if you get the DVD extras, they have the whole Evil League of Evil made out of fanboys and fangirls, right? Many of which were at Dragon Con. And so you can flip through them. And I know at least two people from that are in the official Evil League of Evil in the special features for that same kind of thing. But anyway, so
we have gotten wildly off topic, though. I mean,
again, everyone's seen this movie, but we can catch up really quickly. Ripley wakes up. She's at the Weyland-Yutani base.
She's essentially being put on trial by the company for destroying the $1 million spaceship that blew up at the end.
This movie suffers from the 90s thing, which is that the biggest number we can imagine is a million. They say a million like, this is a multi-million dollar space station. No. It's a $1 trillion space station. I'm sorry. Even
not
in the
including
90s.
Cargo. Not including cargo.
And that would have made it 2 million.
Well, they ground her, basically, by which I mean they take away her license to fly on missions like she was in the first one, and she's forced to become a loader.
This introduces us, though, to a spectacular... Well, actually, I'll ask your opinion. Paul Reiser playing Burke.
Yes.
Do you like him?
I mean, do I like the character? No, he's a scumbag, but do I like what they were doing with him? I think it was fine for what they were trying to go for, because he did kind of take on the Ash role in this movie, where he's like just this really nerdy, almost pathetic figure.
Well, and it's interesting because I will give Jim Cameron this. He got the first movie. The first movie is about the working class schmoes. We don't know why they know about the Xenomorphs, but it's the company trying to make profit. And immediately they realize, hey, this Monsterman might be worth more than anything we've dealt with. So fuck the crew, right? It's like vicious anti-capitalist screed.
See, I disagree that he got Ripley. That was one of the things about the movie.
No. I don't necessarily he got the characters. I say he got the point of the first movie. Because we have the corporate scumbag here to the nth degree. And the idea that people are expendable, right? I think he got that part right. And in that, we have Burke, who is an excellent example of corporate scumbaggery. But so obsessed with the profit motive is he. He doesn't actually realize there's danger until he's literally being torn apart, which is phenomenal. He reminds me of the lawyer in Jurassic Park, which I guess this precedes Jurassic Park.
Paul Reiser's Burke was a fine character. I mean, like I said, the supporting characters in this movie are amazing. They're probably the best supporting characters in the franchise.
In the franchise, yes. We will talk about Bill Paxton's character, because I'm not sure if I love him or absolutely hate him.
I mean, it's the same with me and Newt.
No, Newt is something that we... Yes. Okay, we will disagree with Newt. Okay, so Paul Reiser sort of kind of throws her under the bus at first so that he thinks by throwing her under the bus, she'll have to agree to help him out. It has been 57 years since the first movie.
Okay, and this was one of the scenes in the special edition that wasn't in the theatrical cut. Ripley had a daughter.
Right, that we don't see.
You saw that scene, though, right?
Right, I did. We don't see the daughter, but he knows she has one. They've looked it up, and she died 2 years prior at the age of, like, 68 or something like that. And so it's something held over her head, and therefore, Newt makes much more sense in this version.
If you've ever played Alien Isolation, it's that character that you're playing as.
But again, like, Newt, who's supposed to be an 11 or 12-year-old girl, it's literally a surrogate for the mom. Okay, so he essentially burkles it over her head. Look, I know you don't want to go back, but while we were at the commercial break, everyone on the planet died.
Well, actually, we're skipping a bit, because when Ripley's testifying before this committee, she's talking about the alien, and she was like going, well, why don't you just go back to the planet? It's like, well, because there's been people there for 30 years. It's a shake and bake colony.
This feels like something akin to a Friday the 13th movie, of all things, right? Like, it's an old campground. No one's heard of Jason Voorhees for nigh on 40 years.
Now, this is something I didn't get rewatching the movie, and maybe you have an explanation.
I doubt it, but we'll see.
Okay.
Well, see, she kept the Heart of the Sea on her the whole time, only to throw it overboard at the end of the movie because she's a bitch.
Oh, that's what's happening. So in the first movie, it's established subtly that the company knows what the aliens are.
Right.
They at least know that they're on this planet, and they know how they reproduce by getting a human host. In Aliens, it seems like they have all completely forgotten that not only were their predecessors focused on the aliens and getting them for their weapons department, but have completely forgotten, like, why they designated that planet as being something that would be on their radar. So they put a colony on there that's lasted a couple decades, and then suddenly they're just reminded, oh yeah, there's aliens on this planet that are important for our weapons department. We better go get them. How does that connect?
Unless I'm misinterpreting a scene that happens later, and again, I don't remember if it's in the regular edition or only the special edition that I watched, there's a scene where Ripley, it's Ripley, right? I'm getting it wrong, because I know in episode one I kept wanting to say Ridley, because the director is Ridley Scott and this is Ripley.
Okay. Ellen Ripley, you're good.
Ripley. Oh, we get her first name in this too, which is a weird scene.
Which I think is only in the special edition.
Yeah, that's right. So we have Ripley here talking to Burke, and he goes, I was looking through company archives. I found your signature. You were the one who knew that there were aliens and sent people there to die. So my thought is they didn't know exactly what caused the aliens to grow, but they knew they needed human hosts. So I think they wanted the humans to be infected so that they could capture the live xenomorphs. And this was the crew going to clean them up, but he didn't realize how dangerous they were, because there's no real information. They keep saying in the beginning, there's no information, there's no information, there's no information, there's no even evidence of the alien at all.
Except that would have made sense if this took place like 3 or 4 years after the first movie, but this is 57 years that they established at the start, so
I'm not saying it makes sense. I'm saying that's the explanation we're getting.
To be fair, this was the first time I really thought about it, and this was after seeing the movie a bunch of times.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess that's the problem with sci-fi in general. I guess you're supposed to give them one. And if you don't give them this one, I mean, it's the same thing. We both love Terminator 2.
Yeah.
But the second you start thinking about any of this time travel horseshit, it falls apart. Back to the Future is one of my favorite movies, for God's sake. It makes no sense.
Oh, the first time I saw Terminator 2, I'm like, wait, so if they'd stop Judgment Day, then John Connor doesn't exist. And if he doesn't exist, then Judgment Day is going to happen, which means the first one's going to happen, which means John Connor's going to exist. And
wait, what? So yeah, so that's what we got. Anyway, Ripley essentially says she doesn't want to go, but then they convince her that she's just going to be a consultant along with Space Marines.
Well, what happens is they lose contact with the colony the company's established on LV-426. Mm-hmm. And in the special edition, that's the scene where Newt's family goes out to the ship. Newt's dad gets the facehugger on him. That didn't exist in the theatrical version, because that's what I remember renting from Blockbuster back in the day.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
That's funny, because that is a good scene.
It's a great scene, and it's necessary for the narrative, but because I think in the theatrical version, they just do not introduce Newt until Ripley meets her in the crawl space.
Then makes even less sense.
Yeah.
It already is hard-pressed to figure out how a, 11 or 12-year-old girl has survived this long, but if you're not established to her actually being there, that's really, really weird. So we then load up with some Space Marines. Burke is there, a loser commander named Hicks.
And Sergeant Apone.
Apone, who's great, like cigar chomping. We have Hudson. We have, again, a really good cast of characters. We have Private Vasquez, Jeanette Goldstein, who's also an Avatar.
This is the strangest thing. She's in Terminator 2 and Titanic.
Oh, there you go.
Terminator 2, you probably know. Do you remember her character?
Yes, I do.
John Connor's foster mother.
Yes, the adoptive.
All right.
Yeah.
Who was she in Titanic? Because nobody ever remembers this.
Is she not one of the crew with Bill Paxton?
No.
Oh, who is she?
All right. During the sinking scenes, there's this like one shot towards the end. I think it's when the orchestra, or not the orchestra, that ensemble's on the deck playing. There's this Irish mother that's like telling a fairy tale and tucking her two kids into bed as the ship's sinking because they're about to die. And this is how the mom decides to comfort her kids.
Right.
That's her.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. Again, she's good in this. Al Matthews, as you mentioned. Rico Ross is Frost. And again, all these people, even if you don't know the names, look at pictures of them. You'll recognize them. Like William Hope, he plays Gorman. You wouldn't recognize him, but the second you see his face, you're like, oh, he's in everything. And of course, Lance Hendrickson, he was in AVP, which we did. And Lance Hendrickson.
He's in Alien 3.
He's great. I love Lance Hendrickson. Oh, man.
He was in Hard Target, which we've done. He was the voice of Kerchak in Tarzan, which we've done.
And he has a face out of a Tim Burton movie. I mean, and that's nothing against him. It's just he has deep ridges everywhere. He has a distinguished face that you're just like, yeah, I want you in my movie. And he's just as good doing Shakespeare as he is playing Bishop here, the cyborg.
Now, I've got a question for you.
Oh, I doubt it. Michael Biehn will sign your movie. What's up?
Which movie did you see first in this franchise? Was it this one or was
number
it
number two?
No, okay, it was Me Too.
Yeah.
And I remember it because I think it was on like cable at one point, and I guess it was on HBO, and we had it videotaped on the VCR because you did that back then.
Of course.
I had no idea really like why Ripley hated androids, which comes up in the scene where they introduce Bishop.
Oh, this is so good.
With Bishop doing the knife trick where it's essentially five-fingered filet, but he does it over Bill Paxton's hand as well.
And he closes his eyes and goes, well, robot speed. Like, it's practically a joke from Star Trek TNG with Data, right?
Where Except this came first, so this
would
inspire.
Right, it did.
Yeah.
And again, though, this is something I think maybe you and I will disagree with. But I think Jim Cameron does a good job here. And I get it, because he's kind of aping Ridley Scott. But he does a good job establishing how the cast gets along with each other. Because, you know, it's a scene out of a cantina in Vietnam or something.
Yeah.
But they're good. They're familiar. They're casual. Like, Rodriguez is the saucy Latina woman, and she takes no shit from any of the guys.
You mean Vasquez?
Oh, my God. Yes, I do. I mean, Vasquez. I mean...
Have you ever been confused for a man, Nick?
But I mean, like, she wakes up from cryo sleep or whatever they call it in this. She jumps up, she stretches and starts doing pull-ups, and then she just gives everyone shit. Higgs and Hudson. Hickson. I'm Hudson, sir. That's Hickson. Yeah, fuck you, Bill.
Hudson, sir. He's Hicks.
Yeah, I mean, I love this. I love this all. The problem is, we can disagree on Jim Cameron for the most part. We can agree that this is a good opening to an act, or at least a scene in the middle
it's
of the first
act.
It's
very good at establishing who these characters are.
And then when we watch something like AVP, you realize how people got all the wrong notes.
Right.
Right? Because when they're looking at the giant view screen, like it's the opening to Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego, they're trying to do the same thing with people being cocky and smartass but while they're getting their mission briefing. This is competently directed by a competent director who, again, I will agree, has a George Lucas problem where he wants to get all the leak-glops and the robots into focus. Hey, you know, the Sebulba's a little bit out of focus, guys, but, you know, if we work hard, we can get the robots in. Yeah, Leia, you do that English accent. I don't care. I'm working on this robot.
Oh, boy. You're not wrong.
Yeah.
That'd be an interesting meeting. What if George Lucas and James Cameron ever like had lunch together? What would they talk about?
You know, Jim, there's not enough cars in your movies. You know, you need some cool... Even space cars are cool there, buddy. You know, you could do it.
There's a space tank in my movie. I don't even know how Jim Cameron talks, but there's a space tank in my movie, George.
Well, now, you know, the aliens are great. I like your xenomorphs, though I guess that's kind of Ripley's, buddy. Ridley Scott, you know, you heard him? Or H.R. Puffin stuff. You know, the guy who does all of your characters. They look kind of vaginal there, Jim. Now,
how would you know what that looks like there, George?
Hey, man, I've seen a gobbler or two in my day.
Yeah, no, that broke Daniel.
Broke us both, I think.
I will say, though, I now have never wanted Arnold Schwarzenegger in a Star Wars property more. My goodness, just some sort of hulking. If he showed up in the second season of The Mandalorian as another bounty hunter and just said, "Have you seen this child? I'm looking for the child.
Give this baby Yoda air."
That scene at the end, I'm not going to do a spoiler for that, but watch The Mandalorian. At this point, we have...
Well, we're at a point where we introduce the Marines, and like you said, Ripley is supposed to be the consultant, and they all mock her. It's like, I don't need you to tell me what the species is like, it's where they are. And then they do a drop down into the colony, which at this point is completely abandoned because they've lost contact, and there's all sorts of... destruction, acid burned holes. This part's actually really good because all the Marines have body cams essentially on them, and so we're seeing what they're seeing through those body cams, which makes it look a lot more like a Vietnam newsreel.
Well, and it does the thing that a lot of later sci-fi does, which is that we also have their pulse monitors, and so as they die one by one, the pulse goes flat. It's creepy, it's overwhelming, and it's a realization of Jim Cameron saying, I know where I want my effects scenes to be, so this is going to be very minimal, right? It's essentially found footage. We have bad cameras, screaming, gunshot. Bad camera, screaming, gunshot, flatline. The manager freaking out, trying to get in charge with people, flatline. They cut back to the cameras, people are screaming, the guns are in the wrong direction, they're shooting at nothing, flatline. It's very effective.
Right.
Then the movie's going to stop dead for 20 minutes.
After that initial attack scene where the aliens kill most of the Marines, including the Sarge,
everyone.
Including, almost everyone. Hudson, Vasquez, Hicks.
And that's it. And Hicks is on the ship. He's the guy technically running the mission. Burke is behind Ridley.
Ripley.
Damn it. I'm going to do it again all day.
Burke's on the ship and he lives. And then there's Reiser.
That is Burke. Burke is Paul Reiser.
Who is the driver then of the tank?
That's Hicks.
No, that wasn't Hicks. There was another guy who's
going... There's some women who stay... There's a woman and another dude who stay up on the shuttlecrafts.
Well, there's that guy who gets traumatized because he's trying to relay orders.
That's Hicks.
That's not Hicks. Hicks is Michael Biehn.
Oh, I thought that was Hickson.
Oh, Hickson?
Yeah, I thought Hicks was... Oh my God, we're going to get all over this, aren't we?
I guess so. Hicks is Michael Biehn. We've established that.
Yeah, Michael Biehn is great. Michael Biehn is also in Terminator. And then Gorman is the one we're thinking of.
Yes, okay.
Lieutenant Gorman, William Hope.
Okay,
yes. Gorman is like, he's technically the officer on the ship who's coordinating people, but he is, when things go wrong, he doesn't have a response.
Because he's just used to everything going right.
Well, because as they say, they're the Marines. They've dealt with everything before.
Including, and this would have been interesting to see, other aliens.
Yes. We don't get that, and I don't know what other aliens look like in this world, because these H.R. Giger things are awful. I mean, the xenomorphs are a cool, horrifying design. They really are, and God bless that man and his horrible nightmares, because these are these are like truly remarkable creature designs.
But it would have been interesting, because one of the big things about it is whether or not... I think the company in Ripley's testimony says, oh, well, there's no indigenous life on this planet. It's like, well, this life form isn't indigenous. So what would an indigenous life form look like in this world?
Well, A, and two, as my father would say, there's something incredibly interesting about the fact that we have a whole cast of characters that all seem to matter. They're all established. These aren't dead meats in some horror movie.
And like AVP.
like a AVP or a Freddy movie or a Friday movie or a Halloween movie, right? These are all established characters, and I honestly am not going to look them all up, but I imagine almost none of them had an IMDb background except for maybe Lance Hendrickson.
And Sigourney Weaver. And...
But this is even before Mad About You for Paul Reiser, right? Well, which is a joke, but it's not a joke. Like, that's what he's known for now, other than this.
I remember him from being on that sitcom for 2 weeks that got canceled.
Oh, his sequel to Mad About You, whatever it was called.
All I remember is turning on to watch The Office one evening, and then it was him talking to Larry David.
Oh, God help us. I mean, outside of Curb, I should never see Larry David. I'm done.
Well, I mean, you have a daughter, so he was on one episode of Hannah Montana, apparently. That's not a joke. That happened.
I'm tired, Daniel. Don't. What?
Larry David. Appeared on Hannah Montana.
Of course he did. Anyway, I'm done. That threw me off. But I mean, that to say, it shows that as a casting director and the director had good eyes, because all these people then go on to do a million things. And so to see them in this cast together, it's a great cast. And then when people die, it feels like it has weight. If you told me that the big, heavy Al Matthews, who's like a fucking brick wall of a man chomping on a cigar, doesn't make it out of the first melee. My goodness. I mean, you knew Bell Paxton was because he never stops fucking talking. Speaking of a character that deserves to be a Seinfeld extra. My goodness. We might as well get to him now. What do you think of Private Hudson?
Oh, man.
Game over, man! Game over! Oh, my God. Fucking put a sock in it, asshole. I don't know why this time he bothered the hell out of me. And I'm trying to decide if that makes him a great character or a terrible character.
I think he's kind of supposed to be an annoying prick because he's always expected the other people in his platoon to protect him. I could see what they were going for with him, and I still think it's kind of charming, mostly because Bill Paxton's just such a charming presence anyway.
Well, and it's, again, I mean, you're right. It's Bill Paxton, and I will take him in any movie because we don't have him anymore, A.
Oh, yeah,
and B,
that still sucks.
It does. It sucks every day. But the thing is, he fucking brings it. He is an asshole. But he brings it.
Now, I'll tell you the character who has the biggest negative energy to this movie.
What's that?
Newt.
All right, we'll get to Newt. And what I was trying to think of is, I think he was doing a Private Joker from Full Metal Jacket.
Full Metal Jacket came after this movie.
Do you think Matthew Modine was doing a...
Potentially, yes.
Isn't that weird to say out loud? I don't know why. Something about Kubrick films feel older. It's true that Jim Cameron and Stanley Kubrick were contemporaries.
It's true.
I would also love it. It's one of my favorite things about Spielberg is that he loves video games. That he's like, he had a Genesis and an NES, and that's what he would have in his trailer in between shots. Because, you know, I mean, Kubrick's notorious for taking 200, like, shots to do one thing. But, like, Spielberg was, he's not two takes Jonathan Frakes. But he's, you know, he gets things pretty efficiently. And that while they were setting up, like, shots, he would just be playing like Nintendo. But I like the idea that like that these people have something to do, right? I find that very interesting. I like the idea that Kubrick would put on a fake mustache and go see Aliens and be like, hey, that's interesting.
He'd show up to premieres. I know when Year of the Dragon came out, Kubrick showed up to that premiere, apparently.
I bet you he had buddies that he just supported, right? It's like that new Hollywood movement of the 60s and 70s. Like, yeah, it doesn't make sense, but De Palma fixed Star Wars's opening scrawl because they're just buddies, right? I bet you there's somewhere that he brought some of his wine, but, you know, Capra. Who directed Godfather?
Coppola
brought some wine to Attack of the Clones, right?
And he was there.
Now, George, this isn't your best work, man, but, you know, it's good you're behind the camera again, you know.
Well, to be fair with Kubrick, he was a big chess fan, so between shots, he'd, like, challenge random cast members to chess.
Oh, God. Kubrick, man. I love his movies, I do, but he just seems like he would be awful to be around constantly. And, you know, I wonder if you beat him in chess if he made you do an extra 100 takes.
Well, no one beat him in chess.
Oh, God. Yeah, because they wouldn't want to. They'd be terrified. Hey, Stephen King, it's me, Stanley Kubrick. Do Do you believe in God? I know you've just done coke for 12 hours straight and you're trying to sleep, but do you believe in God?
You need more of a Brooklyn accent.
Hey, yo, Stanley Kubrick. Hey, hey, you want a slice of coke? I'm done. So after this initial melee.
Well, right before the real attack happens, they go towards the center where they're detecting all the life. And before that is when they encounter Newt. Well, in the theatrical version, because she's living in the air ducts.
She is. And she has like a little, like, I don't even know what it is. It's like a little hovel, a little cavern.
Right.
In some like abandoned. It looks like, speaking of movies we actually both like, something out of Brazil. It's like this weird in-between places attached to a bunch of tubes off in the corner, and it's just filled with Michigas because she's been living like...
Yeah, it's like her teddy bear and like a mattress and...
And scraps of food packages.
Right.
And things like that. And, you know, I will agree it's annoying because it stinks of Jim Cameron, and frankly, it stinks of 80s precocious kid movies.
Even beyond that, though, I mean, so many of the basic things about her performance are wrong because she's like switching between American and British accents throughout the movie.
Again, man, it is George Lucas not caring about the actors and more about the gleep-glops.
May I do a line reading for Newt?
Oh, please.
They're dead, all right? Can I go now? Now, my understanding is that
I
think...
funny. I'm going to stop you. I was thinking the whole time you were doing that of Tom Cruise in Mission Impossible, they're dead, all right? They're dead. They're all dead.
I was thinking John Travolta in Battlefield Earth. They're dead. I don't know.
We're never doing that movie, are we?
I've never seen it before. Not all the way through.
We can't.
I think I saw 5 minutes on the Sci-Fi Channel once, back when it was the Sci-Fi Channel. But anyway.
You guys can tell us. I know the second we bring it up, Matt Quinn's going to be like, ooh, that'll be a good one. And the thing is, that means we'd have to watch it. And I don't...
I do kind of want to read the book because I got a copy of the book for free 1 year at a Dragon Con.
Oh, no shit. Oh, that's right. The Scientologist When You Give Blood.
Just the 1 year. But yeah. I've still got my copy of that, and I kind of want to read it because I've heard it's like the Plan 9 of books.
Yeah, I've heard the same thing.
I don't know. For all I know, it could turn out to be the best thing ever written, but
it's
I won't know for
be.
A good long while.
Yeah.
But anyway, I've seen interviews with the person who played Newt. Her name is Carrie Hune, and she isn't an actor anymore.
No, I don't think she is.
I want to say she's a teacher. And has been for like 20, 25 years.
That'd be right. That'd be the right timetable.
Which, good for her. Compared to a lot of child actors, she is a very, very well-adjusted person. So, fantastic. Your performance in this movie was terrible.
I mean, I will disagree. I don't think her performance was terrible. I am happy they didn't give her more to say. This is...
Affirmative.
Fine. But she could have had entire speeches to give. For the most part, she's running, right? We've done so many
she's
kid movies
screaming.
Where she would have been worse.
She has too many speeches, though. They mostly come out at night. Mostly.
That is a stupid line.
Yeah.
Now, that has very little to... A stupid line has very little to do with her, though.
Especially because they never established what daylight is on this planet.
No, it seems dark all the time.
Yeah, exactly.
It does. Other than that, though, I mean, this movie is an aliens movie, so I will say... No, I mean, what are you going to say?
That's interesting how you describe it, though. This movie is an alien movie. It's like, geez, because it's so different from the first one, because there's like...
Well,
so
that's
many
why
action
I added
scenes.
The S, because there's more than one alien. But that's kind of the cool part here, is we see a bunch of xenomorphs moving together. They do a good job at this, right? We see them mostly through this kind of... I don't even know what they call it. They say it's infrared, but it's not infrared. Maybe they don't show up on the infrared. But they're blots on a screen. It looks kind of like a sonar device.
Well, it's the motion detector from the first movie.
But it's now integrated into everything. So everyone has one built into this little device that eventually gets attached to almost all of their guns. It's effective.
There is one other very effective thing about this movie because it establishes the alien life cycle and the alien colony.
Yes.
Which, this is where the queen comes from.
And it's a weird introduction. So, I mean, we can get to it really quickly, but there's a bunch of scenes. People get picked off one by one by one. Xenomorph gets on board the shuttlecraft. It crashes the shuttlecraft, so they get kind of holed up in what looks like an observation tower, something like that, which only has two entrances in and out other than the air duct. So they seal off everything except for these two entrances in and out. And then they realize that due to a power breach, the whole station is going to blow up in about 4 hours. And if they don't get off in 4 hours, they're all going to die.
Well, they put out an SOS call and they're all going to die because essentially they're standing on a nuclear bomb that's powering the colony.
And so they do some quick math. And if Bishop, the cyborg, is the only one who can crawl through these ducts, start the backup shuttlecraft and get to the radio tower to evacuate them in time. They set up some drones. The drones go through 2,000 rounds in seconds because so many xenomorphs are on here. In a scene that is a good use of the budget he had.
Now, this is the closest that we get to a scene from the original Alien movie because we don't see like what the guns do. All we see is Hicks looking at the count of the bullets that are left.
And hearing gunshots.
Right, and hearing gunshots and hearing the aliens screech, but we never see what that looks like. We just see the bullets slowly count down to zero, and as they get closer, we're feeling, oh, fuck.
It is something that I think the special edition does poorly, which is when they come up the south tunnel, and when they get the second set of guns, we do see a couple of xenomorphs get torn apart.
You mean that scene when there's like five or six of them crawling up?
The second set of machine guns, we do see some of them get torn apart. So they ruin that mystery later on.
Mm.
But I do agree with you. It feels more like a Jaws or the first Alien where we don't know what's happening. We just know it's bad. And you get, and again, it's something that Jurassic Park does well, that Jurassic World does not do as well. But the mystery as to what's happening to these people getting eviscerated is truly unsettling, especially since Bill Paxton is off in the corner being like, we're fucked.
Game over, man.
Game over, man. Game over. And
to be fair, he's just watched a whole bunch of his comrades die.
One thing Jim Cameron does is have strong female characters, because the only people not freaking out are Vasquez and Sigourney Weaver, right?
Yeah. Well, Sigourney Weaver, she's not like paralyzed, but she's still scared.
But I will say it's because she told them so.
Yeah.
This is what happened. I mean, I almost want her to grab someone by the scruff and go, this is the sequel. This happened the last time.
She does that, though, with Gorman.
Oh, that's right. And eventually Burke the fuckhead.
Yeah.
Well,
Burke tries to unleash facehuggers because the colonists were like preserving facehuggers and chest bursters in that lab, right? They find it, and there's apparently a couple of alive facehuggers in there because there's that scene where there's that one floating that eventually starts slamming against the glass.
Right. And Burke has ordered them to be preserved. Bishop is like, or she goes, no, when you're done with these tests, I want you to kill them. And he goes, but Mr. Burke told me we're keeping them all and taking them home. And at that point, you realize Burke lied that it was about profit.
Right. He lied that it was about investigating what happened in this colony.
And because he even makes, or she makes him promise that we're not going to take any of them
right.
back. Right.
That's the plan.
Paul Reiser is so good in this.
Well, he gets murdered by an alien, so.
After trying to kill everyone.
Well, he unleashes facehuggers against Ripley and Newt.
Well, and he essentially disables whatever's keeping them in cryostasis or whatever, and then locks the door, so they're stuck. Ripley gets out by setting off the smoke alarms. In a scene which is, I think, very effective, she's pantomiming being attacked, right? Because, like, one is coming at her neck, and she's holding it away as it's wrapping around her spine. And then everyone comes and pulls it off of him.
Oh, yeah, that's right. We're,
it's a good scene.
Yeah.
And they're like, and she figures it out. She's like, look, they realize they can't get these facehuggers through. So they're going to have them impregnate us and then kill you guys in cryosleep so he can get back with all this shit.
Right.
Right. And the thing which is interesting is she's literally preventing the apocalypse against the corporation who wants it to happen, right? Like, which, again, Jim Cameron, it's Skynet. man. Like, everyone's like, this is great technology. This company is going to save the world. Oh, wait, they're actually trying to kill everyone on Earth.
Yeah. Unintentionally still, it's just like, oh, we get this back to Earth, we'll be multi-gazillionaires.
I mean, it's underpants gnome logic, right? It's like, step one, bring back Xenomorph. Step two, step three, profit. Hey!
Yeah.
But
so I know in the special edition regards to this is there's that scene earlier where they speculate like how the aliens reproduce. And I think it's Hudson who's like, it's like a bee hill.
A bee hill. Yeah. And it's funny because he gets dumber and dumber and everyone's like, hey, asshole, you mean anthill or beehive? It's beehive, asshole. Like, and he goes, I don't care, motherfuckers. I'm just...
Either way, he's right, though, because that's exactly what's going on.
I mean, and we can get there. They're trying to escape. Everything's going according to plan. Bishop is sending the ship. They're about to get out. And then fucking Newt falls down a laundry chute somewhere.
Oh, yeah, and into that, sewer?
And she runs into a Ninja Turtle. They're cutting through the floorboard as everyone's arriving, and then all of a sudden, in what is a truly horrifying shot out of Jaws or something, right? The Xenomorph stands up fully erect, hugs her down, and she's just fucking gone.
Say erect again there, Nick.
Erect. And
hey, baby.
For the first time, Sigourney Weaver's like, she's alive, she's alive, she's alive, she's
right.
alive. We need to go get her. And Michael Biehn's like, okay, we can go get her. We can go get her, but first we have to not die right now.
Now, that scene's after the breakout in the lab and the extra battle after the automated guns run out of bullets. So by this point, that Newt's kidnapped. Paul Reiser's dead. Hudson's dead. Vasquez is dead. They were killed in
Gorman
another ambush.
Gorman is dead. And actually, what's kind of a cool redeeming scene, because Vasquez is sealing up doors as they go. A Xenomorph comes out of the ceiling, and like a badass, she kicks it in the head, shoots it to death, but the acid eats through one of her legs. Gorman goes back to try to, like, save her, but they're being surrounded by Xenomorphs on all sides. They pull out what looks like a Star Wars thermo detonator and blow them all to hell. It's a good scene. Like, and by the way, Gorman at this point is irredeemable, but this is the closest to redemption he's going to get.
Meanwhile, Hudson just got pulled under the floor grating.
It means he can, you know, quantum leap to the next world where he's going to be killed by a predator. Right? I mean,
yeah.
That's all I got. At this point, Paul Reiser has gone from trying to kill them there to locking doors behind him to save himself, but he locks himself in a room with a Xenomorph, which again, frankly, feels like Jurassic Park with Dennis Nedry as he's trying to escape to save his own ass, ends up being killed by the Dilophosaurus.
So should we get into like the final Alien Queen fight? Because so there's a scene where we see the Alien Queen all hooked up and laying eggs, but the planet's about to get nuked, and supposedly the Queen dies in that, and they're all flying away.
Essentially, Sigourney Weaver goes and rescues Newt. When she's taken by the Xenomorph, she's not killed. She's going to be a victim. So they have done the thing where they kind of attach her to this mucus web thing to the wall.
Right.
Weaver, Ripley, gets there just in time to blow it apart, the face hugger, as Newt's about to be impregnated.
Phrasing.
But that's what they call it, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
As they're escaping, I mean, this is a horror movie. They stumble across the birthing room. At this point, Bishop and Ripley have kind of logicked through. They've Scooby-Dooed through, like, well, okay, so it needs a host to become an alien, fully formed Xenomorph, as they now call it. And he goes, yes. Well, but who's laying the eggs? And that's where we get the scene that we talked about, where Paxton is like, well, it's got to be some sort of queen, you know, as he calls it.
Like
massive,
a bee hill.
A big fucking bitch of some sort, right? And, well, we see it. It looks like a Xenomorph, but bigger, with this giant kind of head plating thing that looks like a scarab beetle or something.
The late, great Stan Winston created the queen.
Yeah, he's given the credits like a second unit director. He did a lot of the special effect direction. And again, give Jim Cramer credit for that. Like, those shots, look phenomenal. And I'm sure there was a lot of CGI. I'm sure there's a lot of practical effects.
I think it was more practical effects because the queen still just looks like a puppet.
Good CGI is always scaffolding. It's always the little things that help it blend. Most of the effects should be practical. And frankly, the scenes that look the worst are the spaceship flying through space.
Yeah.
Everything on the ground looks realistic. I'm sure there's an entire basement world filled with miniatures somewhere, because I'm sure they made millions of little miniatures and they look phenomenal. They really do.
You're not wrong.
This alien queen is agile and smart in a way that none of the rest of them are. The rest really do feel like drones. She feels like she's logicking out this stuff.
Well, after that initial encounter, they launch off the planet because, you know, the nuclear reactor's about to go. And everything looks fine, but then Bishop's talking to Ripley, and the queen stabs Bishop and tears him in half.
Ripley's this close to saying, no, he was one of the good ones.
And that's where we get into the final boss battle of this movie.
I will say, though, I thought it was stupid as hell, and maybe you disagree. The queen uses an elevator at one point. She figures out an elevator. And I was just like, no.
Compared to some of the other things in this movie, especially around Newt's dialogue.
Okay, fair. And so we have a scene where you think they're about to get away. This is, I don't want to say this drags because it's good, but this is all right, end the movie.
Well, we get Ripley coming out and saying her most famous line after she hooks herself back up to the loader.
Die, you bitch.
Let her go, you bitch.
There you go. And they have a fight scene between this this mech suit and the queen, the alien queen.
And eventually alien queen gets shoved out an airlock that was on the floor of the station.
And Bishop importantly saves Newt because they essentially open up a hole into space.
Right. It's a hole in the floor where Ripley's using one of the claws on the loader lifter to hold onto the floor, but Newt starts flying, and then Bishop, who's been torn in half again, so it's just him, his arm, and all the white guts that are in the androids in this franchise.
Yeah. Essentially what happens is the mech loader falls into a hole. Ripley's holding on for dear life. It opens. It grabs her foot. The alien grabs her foot.
Right.
It's a dramatic scene. At the end, everyone's safe, and she loads everyone into their sleeping bays. Newt, Ripley, Bishop, and Hicks is still alive. Hicks is still alive. One by one, they close, and we fade to black.
There's that one line where Newt's been talking about bad dreams, and at the end, she looks at him and is like, is it okay to dream now?
Yeah.
Yep,
which
you
is
can
a line
dream.
You hated? It's nothing.
It was okay. I didn't really feel anything about it one way or the other.
See, it's funny. What I disagree with is fundamentally the need to have a kid at all in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
But frankly, if they're going to have a kid, I don't think she's terrible. That's where I'm going to come down at. I don't know why they felt the urge to have it, especially since the first one, all you needed was a cat to prove that they were people.
Well, because this was 1986, so it was a much more conservative environment than what birthed the original Alien.
Well, but
that's not a pun, by the way, but it was like the studio could only view women as mothers.
I mean, I get it. What they should have had is one of the Mighty Ducks. Just someone with a little bit of sassiness. I don't know. We've talked about this long enough. Let's wrap this baby up. Daniel, why don't you tell me, worth it, not worth it? Final judgment.
It's worth it, but at the same time, I know some people who think this is the greatest movie of all time, and it's really not. There's a bunch of flaws. We talked about a plot hole with how, Weyland-Yutani knows about what's on the planet, and, Newt is just such an annoying character. But there is a lot to like about the movie. I mean, the action scenes are well put together. The supporting characters are fantastic. The final boss battle, for lack of a better word, it's fine. It's effective. I get why people like this, but maybe it's just my Jim Cameron bias. There's a lot that's holding this movie back for me, which I don't know. Maybe I should watch The Abyss because I've never seen it. And maybe that'll finally just lock everything into place for me.
My final thoughts is I would recommend it. I think it's great. It's funny, rewatching it now, especially compared to the first one, the atmosphere is still there. But I thought of this one as the more action one, and it is more action-y compared to the first one, but it's not an action movie. There are action scenes in it, but it'd be like calling, you know, Jurassic Park a comedy or something. I don't know. Like, there are funny moments, but it's not there. I don't hate Newt as much as Daniel does, clearly, but I also am not sure how to classify this movie fully. All in all, I think it's excellent. I'd recommend it. I also don't know which version I'd recommend you see.
Special edition.
I like this special edition. I think it adds more to the character, but it has even more of the problem I talked about, which is that the action scenes then feel further apart. And so if you're in it to see as an action movie, I'd say see the theatrical release. This is more of a full movie to see the director's cut. But it's like Alien. The first Alien, it's all about the horror elements. And the pacing makes space feel more abysmal. Imagine adding a few extra scenes there. You might have a more complete characters, but it will feel less like a horror movie. This one feels less like an action movie the more I learn about the characters. I don't care about half the people in Predator. I just want to see them killed. But, as Daniel said, this backup cast is phenomenal, so I kind of want to find out more about them. I think the director's cut here is a better choice, but it makes it a less action-y of a movie. But next month we're doing the third one, which Daniel says is he likes more than the second one. I haven't seen it in so long, I can't make a judgment.
I think it's a more appropriate sequel to the first Alien.
And then we'll do the fourth one, which I have not really seen all the way through, and frankly, I'm not looking forward to.
Ooh, it is, your assessment is correct.
Fair enough. So I guess stay tuned next week and every future week as we put a piece of your past on trial, and I guess once a month, as for you, our beloved Patreon people, we talk about an Alien movie. Thanks, guys.
Life Between Your Childhood is a product of Dude Letter Podcasting. It is hosted by Nick Hoffman, produced by Nick Hoffman, Daniel Suttis, and Matthew Quinn, and edited by Daniel Suttis. Our theme song is Surf Shimmy by Kevin MacLeod from incomptech.com, licensed under Creative Commons license by Attribution 3.0 license.